The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
HallReview.com.
If we look to the answer as to why for so many years we achieved so much, prospered as no other people on earth, it was because here in this land we unleashed the energy and individual genius of man to a greater extent than has ever been done before. Those who say that we're in a time when there are no heroes, they just don't know where to look. The sloping hills of Arlington National Cemetery, with its row upon row of simple white markers bearing crosses or stars of David, they add up to only a tiny fraction of the price that has been paid for our freedom. As for the enemies of freedom, those who are potential adversaries, they will be reminded that peace is the highest aspiration of the American people. We will negotiate for it, sacrifice for it. We will not surrender for it now or ever. We are Americans.
Welcome to Always Right Radio with Bob Frantz on AM 1420, The Answer.
Welcome indeed. Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us. It is now 7 minutes after the hour of 9 o'clock. Oh, I'm a liar. Seth's going to call me a liar if I don't get it down to the second. It's now 8 minutes after the hour of 9 o'clock on this Tuesday morning. It is the fifth morning of the third month in the year of our Lord 2024. Hey, be careful out there. It seems like everybody is playing bumper cars. Coming in to headed east on 480, there was an accident right near my house in North Ridgeville. I don't live in North Ridgeville, but close to it. There was one there. Get on 480. There's one in the middle of 480 just between Great Northern and the airport. Then there's another one at the airport. It's just like bing, bang, boom. Everybody's playing bumper cars today, so be very, very careful. We almost had a catastrophe at the start of the show today. The catastrophe would have been dead air. That would have been a problem. So please be careful out there this morning. It's a Tuesday, and you know what that means. Good news, it is a Kersenau day. That is a great thing. Peter Kersenau will join us coming up in 1 hour, and he's going to talk about law-type stuff, which is a good thing because he's a law-type person. He's an attorney and a member of the Commission on Civil Rights, obviously, on the decision by the Supreme Court to allow Donald Trump to appear on the Colorado, Illinois, and Maine ballots and every other state that was thinking about trying to remove him. The 9-0 Supreme Court decision yesterday. We'll get his thoughts on that. And now the next one is, what about immunity? Is there a presidential immunity, or is there not? Hugh was just talking about it all morning long and saying, I don't know how they're going to go on this one. And I don't either. This is a difficult thing. There has to, and Trump said, if you don't have presidential immunity, then you don't really have a president. In other words, if the president cannot pretty much do what he wants, if he has to fear being sued or locked up or whatever, however that, you know, looks, then you don't really have a leader, and you cannot have a leader. And I think there's some truth to that, but you also have to make sure that, you know, they know that a president can't just literally go around committing, you know, violent felonies or something of that nature and still have immunity. But, you know, the point is a good one. We're going to have to talk about that with Kersenau.
And while we're on the subject, and another thing that will be coming up very soon will be immunity for a president, and not immunity for me, but for any president. If a president doesn't have full immunity, you really don't have a president, because nobody that is serving in that office will have the courage to make, in many cases, what would be the right decision, or it could be the wrong decision. It could be, in some cases, the wrong decision, but they have to make decisions, and they have to make them free of all terror that can be rained upon them when they leave office or even before they leave office.
He's not wrong. He's not wrong. I saw a really great analysis of the presidential immunity question early this morning. I got up early and was working on a few things. Kurt Schlichter, our friend from senior columnist at townhall.com, and he's a sometimes fill-in host on the Hugh Hewitt Show, too. But Kurt wrote a really interesting piece about immunity. And it's not definitive. It doesn't say this is the way it's going to be, but there are very important issues to consider when it comes to that question. And I'm going to share that with you in a bit. And I'm going to share it with Kirsten now, too, and we'll have that conversation at 10:10 this morning. So Pete is our only guest. That means hour number one is free for you, and hour number three is free for you to join me with your questions and comments and whatever it is that you feel like offering to the discussion today. 216-901-0945 and 888-281-1110. Before we get started with the news of the day and some of our top stories, we will indeed talk about the meltdown that the radical left has had since finding out that the Supreme Court contains people who actually believe in what the Constitution says, and not just left-wing ideologues, at least three of them. That's right. Elena, Sonia, and Kentanji all decided the same thing that Amy and Johnny and Clarence and Sam and who am I missing? Oh, and Neil all decided. How about that? People who are constitutionalists and people who are activists, even they could all agree on the fact that, no, you can't boot the leading candidate for the opposition party from the presidential ballot on the most ridiculous claim of insurrection in the third segment of the 14th Amendment. Are you kidding me? I think everybody knew what was coming, and the left melted down anyway, even though they had to know this was coming. So we're going to talk about that here in just a minute or two. But first, let's go ahead and do our pledge. Patriots, stand and face your flag. Put your hand on your heart and join us for this if you are indeed a patriot. If you are not, if you are mad, let me put it to you this way. If you were livid yesterday that the Supreme Court did the right thing by upholding, you know, the reality of the Constitution and not the fake version of it that the left wanted them to do, then you don't believe in the Constitution. You don't believe in the country. And if you don't believe in the country, you don't believe in the flag that represents it. So just. Instead of standing up, you can go ahead and take a knee and put your head down like the shameful Marxist you are. For the rest of us, however,
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
13 minutes after 9 o'clock, and I welcome you to the program at 216-901-0945 and 888-281-1110 as soon as you've got something that you believe is worthwhile to say this morning. This was not a close call. It wasn't going to be a close call. It broke when we were in the middle of a show yesterday, and we just meant it. You saw the way I treated it. Well, if you listen every day, you heard the way I treated it yesterday. I just mentioned it. Who were we on with? Seth, who were we on with when that came down? And I said, oh, was it the top of the second hour going into my interview with Donovan? I think it was.
Yes, it was Donovan O'Neill.
It was after Jim Jordan.
Yes.
And then before Donovan O'Neill is when we talked about it at the very top. And so maybe it's because I was headed into an interview that I didn't want to dwell, but I mean, I didn't think I had to dwell. I think everybody knew the moment the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case of the Colorado Supreme Court kicking Trump off the ballot, we knew darn well this was not constitutional, and we knew darn well what they were going to do. In fact, we speculated that day that it would be a probably unanimous verdict, you know, a unanimous ruling 9-0. I didn't know if it would actually come true, but we talked about it at the time, didn't we?
Yes, we did. CNN, however, did not see it that way.
At the time?
After it came down.
Well, that's kind of, yeah, then that's the whole point of the segment I'm about to do here, because we knew. I mean, I gave it very, very scant attention yesterday because I was just like, oh, as expected. And we just moved right on with the day because they were never going to keep him off the ballot with a ridiculous thing like the 14th Amendment. They were just never going to be able to do that. They're, from a legal perspective, from a historic perspective, there's just no argument to be made there to deny the American people their right to their democracy. And everybody needs to understand this. I hate speaking in terms like this that border on almost being, what's the word I'm looking for, elementary. because I feel like this audience is intelligent and knows the difference between a democracy and a representative republic. But then again, Dennis Prager at our event on Saturday night spelled it out. He said, yeah, everybody needs to know. And there was a very intelligent room full of political people and activists and analysts and supporters and donors and so forth. So I don't mean to be condescending in any way. But, you know, it is a democratic act. That's what the act of voting is. That is what democracy is the act of voting. We are not a democracy as a noun in that way. We are a republic in that we choose representatives to go and make our decisions for us. Our representatives go to Congress and work in the White House. And yes, then we entrust justices to be appointed to work for us and represent us in our three-tiered system of justice. So we are a representative republic, not a democracy, but the act of democracy is what's under attack. If you try to say that one of the two leading people in a presidential contest can't appear on the ballot because it's the best way to make sure he can't win the vote, keep him away from getting votes, take him off. You just can't do that in an actual functioning democratic society. And yes, the act of voting is democracy. They claim that we're the ones trying to take democracy away from the people, and it is literally them who tried to do that. So to me, it was no big deal. And the reality is the 9-0 verdict was a grand slam. It should have been expected. It was expected.
So here to react is Fox News contributor Joe Concha. Joe, your reaction.
Well, when this decision came back, Ainsley, and it comes back 9-0, it's a grand slam. It's a slam dunk. There's no ambiguity. The first thought that I had was, well, even the usual suspects in this business won't be able to say, well, this is about the extreme MAGA Supreme Court that's just there to save Donald Trump, because obviously we had Kagan and Sotomayor and Ketanji Brown also joined the conservative members on the bench in agreeing that Donald Trump should be on the ballot. And instead, we got the 2024 version of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. You just played all of those thoughts there. And those are sound bites, of course. And no matter how this was going to come back, that was going to be the reaction. I mean, we saw, for example, George Conway, who's like the Michael Avenatti of legal analysts over on CNN, calling the Supreme Court fundamentally incoherent and a shoddy legal work in terms of their conclusion. You had ABC News' Jonathan Carl somehow coming away with this takeaway. Despite wins, Supreme Court strikes blow to Trump's central campaign theme. Trump's central campaign theme is that his opponents are trying to take him out in the courtroom instead of at the ballot box. And that's the whole crux of this argument. Should voters decide whether Donald Trump is president or not, or should some partisan judges or partisan secretaries of state do that? I think leaving it in the hands of the people is something that many would agree with, even Democrats who are sane and sober, who just want this thing decided by the people.
Of course, that is assuming there are sane and sober Democrats. I have not seen much evidence of that, but he's right on the rest of what he said. They want to defeat Donald Trump in the courts because they know they cannot beat him fair and square at the ballot box. Joe Biden is cratering. And I mean, seriously, the crater just gets deeper and deeper and deeper with every new poll that comes out. He's going to get trounced unless something dramatic happens, unless Donald Trump is arrested again, but this time not for, you know, alleged fraud or classified documentation or civil cases or any other crap that they're throwing at him. But unless he's arrested for, you know, a carjacking or something, Donald Trump is going to be the nominee, and unless the Democrats literally just decide to throw their party in the toilet and try to build a new one in 6 months, Joe Biden has to be their nominee. And if those things happen, and unless they engineer another disease, another viral outbreak in the next couple of months, and declare nobody's allowed to go to the ballot boxes again, the voting precincts, and actually vote in person, and we get to do mail-in and ballot drop boxes again, there is no way they win. They know that. So since they can't beat him in the actual election, they have to try to beat him in courts of law now. That is truthful. And let's point to some evidence of that if we can. Or do you want to hear one more cry? I kind of want to hear one more. I mean, she doesn't actually cry here, but it sounds like her voice is breaking to the point where she is in the longer clip of this. But here's a 28-second clip of the Secretary of State of Colorado, who was just so saddened by the Supreme Court's obvious decision yesterday.
My larger reaction is disappointment. I do believe that states should be able, under our Constitution, to...
She's doing a pretty good job in terms of how it sounds, but you, if you can see the video, and this is radio, I know you cannot, she is... Her chin is like literally quivering, like somebody you know who's like a child who's been confronted by a grown up about something. But let me hear the full thing.
My larger reaction is disappointment. I do believe that states should be able, under our Constitution, to bar oath breaking insurrectionists. And ultimately, this decision leaves open the door for Congress to act, to pass authorizing legislation. But we know that Congress is a nearly non-functioning body. So ultimately, it will be up to the American voters to save our democracy in November.
There it is. And there's that line again. And it's so bizarre. Her eyes are fluttering like you kind of see usually women, but somebody do before they cry. Her eyes are fluttering and her chin is quivering as she's talking about how it's going to be up to the American voters to save our democracy. They continue to use that line, and it continues to be equal parts pathetic and hilarious. They continue to talk about saving democracy. She's literally crying about the fact that the American people won't be denied democracy. She wanted to deny the American people the choice of candidate A or candidate B, the leaders of the two respective parties. She wanted to take candidate B and remove him so that candidate A can get all of the Colorado votes unmolested. Or that the other party, the party of candidate B, would have to throw somebody in at the last second and say, here's the other option. She wanted to literally remove democracy from the presidential election. And then she's saying it's up to the American voters to save democracy. What on earth do these people, how stupid do they think we are that we don't know what they are doing? And now let's talk about why they are doing it. I gave you some numbers yesterday. I didn't give you some of the numbers inside the numbers, but I think they're worthwhile here. The reason the left is melting down over this, even though we all knew this was going to be a Supreme Court decision in Trump's favor, many of us knew and predicted that it would be a 9-0 decision. So why are they so melting down over this anyway? And the tears, by the way, some of them are real. You know, hers, like I said, she fought them off. But some of the others are real, as is the rage. Go on leftist Twitter and just look at, you know, what the MSNBC crowd is tweeting, what the CNN crowd is tweeting, what the, you know, non-functioning media, people like Keith Olbermann and Conway and these other people are tweeting, and they are just screaming. What are they screaming? Abolish the Supreme Court! Mind you, it was only couple of years ago, 3 years ago, they said if we keep control of the Senate and the House and we get Biden as president, we have to pack the Supreme Court, grow it to 11 or 13 or 15 or whatever it takes to make sure that we have a strong majority and let Biden appoint them all the new ones. They said pack the Supreme Court. Now that they see that the three left-wing justices on the court sided with the originalists, who I will not call conservatives on the court, all they are is originalists and constitutionalists, which is what we demand of our justices. By the way, we don't want activists, even right-wing activists. We want constitutional. It's not a coincidence that constitutional and conservative start with the first four letters the same. Constitutional originalists are what we want on the court. But three left-wing activists had to, because there was just no choice, side with the conservatives. And they did. Or the constitutionalists. And they did. So even a packed court wouldn't matter, because you would have, you know, no choice, or they would have no choice, unless they completely just ignored the Constitution. But they would have no choice to do this. So now, instead of pack the court, pack the court, pack the court, which they said before Biden became president, notice how I didn't say was elected, became president, now they're saying abolish the court. The Supreme Court must be dissolved. Holy goodness. That's how far, you know, outside their mind they are. Listen, TDS is thrown around a lot, and it has been since 2015. when Trump came down the golden escalator. Trump derangement syndrome is a cute little phrase for media and for talk shows like this one. And, oh, you know, the left is big mad. They got TDS. I don't think it's just a meme. I don't think it's just a, you know, a way of saying, oh, you know, look how crazy these people are. I think there's a legitimate psychological disorder here that has to be identified and defined. It's not just, like I said, somebody's big mad. There is a disorder in the mind of an American leftist that is literally affecting their ability to function, to think with clarity and coherence, to speak, you know, on matters without just extreme emotion overtaking any sense of reason or rationality that they may otherwise possess. Emotion runs it all when it comes to Trump. That's what Trump derangement syndrome is. I honestly believe if there was a randomized controlled study of people who claim they hate Donald Trump, and there could be neurological studies of their brains done, they would find it just as assuredly as they can identify and diagnose bipolar disorder, a split personality disorder, gender dysphoria. There are real brain impairments, mental impairments that are identifiable from those kinds of studies. And I think if something like that was done, you would find an actual Trump derangement syndrome disorder that could be defined, because it's the only way to explain what we are watching and listening to right now. All right, I'll get to the specifics of those numbers I wanted to get to in a moment. Like I said, I got chased off the track there for a moment, but we'll take a bottom of the hour.
D.com/credit.
Waking up America from its woke slumber. Always Right Radio with Bob Frantz on The Answer.
Okay, 9:34, it's Always Right Radio on AM 1420, The Answer. Curse an hour and a half an hour. If you want to get in, we can take your calls. I know I say that a lot, and then I say a lot. So 216-901-0945 and 888-281-1110. Let's get you up and on the radio, but I do have still a lot. I want to get to the numbers that I was discussing yesterday, because we're kind of trying to figure out, I guess, why the freak out. You know, they had to know this was coming. There's no way they were going to just pull something as simple as, I know how we'll beat him. We'll just keep him off the ballot. We'll say that he committed an insurrection, even though, and this is what the Colorado Supreme Court did, you know, even though there was no conviction, no trial, even no charge of insurrection in a court of law that would have led the Colorado Supreme Court to say, yeah, he committed insurrection, and therefore he's banned from the ballot. They knew it wasn't going to work, or at least they had to know that it was not going to work, and yet they melted down anyway, screaming and crying and saying we need to abolish the Supreme Court. David French is almost a poster child of the TDS people, the Trump derangement syndrome people. David French wrote an article yesterday after this came down, in which he declared that the Supreme Court just erased part of the Constitution, as opposed to upheld the Constitution, because we all know what the 14th Amendment was about, and we all know that it was about the Civil War, and it was all about Confederate leaders becoming federal office holders in the newly reunited states of America. We knew what that was. This has nothing to do with that. Secondly, as I said yesterday, and this is just where I try to inject a little bit of common sense into these discussions, and I brought this up yesterday, and it is commonly sensible. If Donald Trump was trying to literally overthrow the government, which is what an insurrection is, it's a coup d'etat, if he was trying to literally do that, would he have told his people to go there peacefully and patriotically? And would he have expected them to go there unarmed? If the goal was break into the Capitol and hold everybody hostage at gunpoint until they overturn the results of the election and declare me still president, that would be an insurrection. Would he have told these people to go there and be peaceful and patriotic, would he have even, wouldn't he have planned this a little bit more quietly? Wouldn't he have just kind of worked behind the scenes to get a crowd to go there so that they could arm themselves more? Would he have actually called for the placement of 10,000 or so National Guardsmen to secure the Capitol because he knew the protest was going to happen? And protests always lead to counter-protests, which always lead to violence, and he didn't want any violence to happen at the Capitol. What the hell kind of insurrectionist is he? You're an insurrectionist, and you actually want to position defensive guards in front of the place that you're trying to take over? Who does that? If you're really trying to commit an insurrection, you'd be saying, you know, I don't think you need to have police and guards there. I mean, we're peaceful people. Try to get them to lower their guard so that it would be easier to take that over. There was no insurrection. This is so ridiculous and so insane. But this is what Trump derangement syndrome does. So they lost their minds collectively over this yesterday. And as I said, I wanted just to kind of explain why. When I give you numbers from a Rasmussen poll, Rasmussen has a reputation among the left as being right-leaning, and so therefore they might be push-polling, so it might not be a real, true, legitimate temperature that's being taken of the American voter. They try to do that in the same way that I might say, I don't trust a CNN poll. Okay, so let's play that game. Let's say for a second that push-polling does happen on both sides of the aisle. Maybe it does. In fact, I know it does on the left side of the aisle, but I'll stipulate for the purposes of this conversation that sometimes maybe a more conservative polling service might do it too. The poll that we're talking about that has people on the left freaked out right now with their TDS on tilt. Their TDS is just, I mean, it's blaring in their head like the voice is just screaming. I wonder what it looks like. I wonder what it sounds like inside the head of a TDS leftist. Like inside their head, do they just see the orange man's face screaming, Bigly, Bigly, and just a bunch of other Trumpisms? I mean, it makes them so deranged. This is what it is. The poll that came out right before the Supreme Court decision was not a Rasmussen poll. It was not a Fox News poll. It wasn't One American News. It wasn't Salem. It wasn't Newsmax. The poll that came out was a New York Times poll. I mean, if anybody can be called left of the leftists, it's the New York Times and probably the Washington Post. So knowing what we know about their ideology and their bent or their slant, we have to take these numbers, and the left took these numbers and said, oh my God. And what did those numbers show? The New York Times Siena College poll that was just published Sunday, the day before this Supreme Court announcement was made yesterday, found a plurality, 43% of voters say that Biden's policies have hurt them. 18% of those voters say Biden's policies have helped them. Another 39% feel Biden's actions have not made much of a difference either way to them personally. Trump's numbers among all respondents in this, did I mention it was a New York Times poll, are significantly inverted when compared to Biden's. A plurality, 40%, say Trump's policies helped them personally. 25% say the policies affected them negatively. The remaining 34% did not report being affected one way or the other. So this isn't just about who you voting for numbers. That was also astounding, by the way. Trump by 5. Outside the margin of error. Trump 48, Biden 43 by the New York Times poll. But within the poll, the individual questions, 43% say Biden's policies have hurt them, a plurality. 40% say Trump's policies helped them, the inverted plurality. This is devastating news to the left. An even more troubling sign for Biden, which has had to be why they melted down yesterday after the Supreme Court said, "Good, you can't do this," becomes apparent when focusing on the subgroups of the respondents, including demographics like Latino and Black and women voters. Of Latinos polled, only 15% say Biden's policies have benefited them. 36% of Latinos, mind you, and this is at a time when there's, you know, a wide open border for Latinos and Latinas and people of Central and Latin American and South American descent come streaming across our border. 36% of them say Biden's policies are hurting them. 49% say neither good nor bad. Conversely, 37%, again, the exact inverse number of the Biden numbers, 37% of the Latino respondents say Trump's policies helped them. 22% say that his policies hurt them. What about Blacks? More Black voters say they have benefited from Trump's policies than Biden's policies. Again, this has to be just, they're starting to spend their downtime fashioning nooses. Not for lynching, but for their own end of it all. They're thinking about ways to exit either this world or this country, because this is too much for them. 26% of Black voters say their lives improved thanks to Trump's agenda. 17% of Biden's policies helped them personally. Let me say that again. 26% of Black voters, Trump's policies helped us. 17% of Biden voters, Biden's policies helped us. This is extraordinary. Conversely, 21% of Black respondents say they have been harmed by Biden's policies, while Trump hurt 24%, according to Trump's policies hurt 24%, according to the numbers. So in other words, that's virtually a dead heat. And as you know, and Peter Kirstenow talks all the time, for Democrats to continue to carry elections, they have to win over 2% or so of Black votes. We'll ask him about that when he comes on. More than 60% of Black respondents say Biden's policies has neither hurt nor helped, while just under 50% say the same thing of Trump. And then the same trend continues with women. More women say Biden's policies have negatively impacted them, 40%, than positively impacted them, 18%. In comparison, 41%, Trump has 39% of the women say his policies have benefited them. Just 26% say they have been negatively impacted. The poll was conducted February 25th through the 28th, and the biggest number and the most important number from this is the one that I mentioned yesterday when I told you the story. And that is that a significant majority of those who now favor Trump favored Biden and voted for him in 2020. That means it's not like we're polling people who are fresh and new. They polled people who had already voted for Biden, and those voters are flipping now and supporting Trump. You want to know why they're screaming? You want to know why they're crying? You want to know why they're telling the Supreme Court to go blank itself, calling for the, and that's one of Olbermann's prize lines, by the way. You want to know why they are calling for the abolition of the Supreme Court, saying that the Supreme Court is now an activist body and blah, blah, blah. The reason is this. The reason is they know that at the ballot box, they cannot win. Without cheating and carrying out another massive election fraud, they know that they cannot win. The only way they can beat him is to beat him in the courts, and to try to keep him off the ballot altogether. Trying to find yesterday's TDS, Trump Derangement Syndrome. You know, they might not even need to study a massive randomized controlled study. Just, take Keith Olbermann's brain. He's obviously not using it. Take it and study it, and it will be the ultimate case study of what TDS looks like. You can use that as kind of like the model, and then compare that brain to others. But yesterday, Olbermann went off on his, I'm trying to see if I can pull it up, among his just legions of unhinged tweets in response to what the Supreme Court did yesterday. The one I'm looking for specifically is the one that said, blank you, Elena Kagan, blank you, Sonia Sotomayor, blank you. I guess I don't need to see it if I have it memorized. Blank you, Ketanji Brown Jackson, and then accuse them all of being, you know, whatever tools of the right. So, quite literally, Trump derangement syndrome is real, and you can see why it is really, really symptomatic in so many right now. Because Trump is winning. Trump is winning in the battleground states. Trump is winning in the overall polls, including those conducted by the New York Times. And Trump is winning in the courts as well. They can not handle it. Reality. Okay. Don is in Lakewood. Hello, Don. You're on AM 1420, The Answer. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hey, Bob. I had a moment of clarity when you mentioned, you know, this discussion about Trump derangement syndrome. Because have you heard of a process called neuroplasticity?
No, I have not.
Okay. It is a biological, psychological process by which the body, the brain, literally can be reprogrammed by thinking in a certain manner. If you have a lot of depressive thoughts, a lot of negative thoughts, like grooves in a record getting deeper, neurological pathways get reinforced to go in a certain direction. So if you're obsessed with a certain thing, those pathways literally get reinforced in the brain. And I'm like, oh my God, Trump, yes, TDS is real for these people. And it does explain a lot of the behaviors of people, like friends of my wife and I who no longer speak to us. Neuroplasticity, you got to look it up, because it helps those with depression, those with other psychological conditions. And it is literally a chemical process in the brain that can reinforce either negative or positive behaviors and thoughts. That does explain a lot of the behaviors that we're seeing, and it's terrifying because these people are literally reprogramming themselves with the hate that they cannot get out of. They're on a downward spiral. And they're not apt to even consider other opinions once they get to a certain point.
Everything you just said makes sense. And it, particularly going back to the great metaphor, like record grooves in vinyl. That's a really, really great way to look at this. I looked it up while you were talking. Psychology Today gives this definition. Neuroplasticity is the brain's capacity to continue growing and evolving in response to life experiences. Plasticity is the capacity to be shaped, molded, or altered. Neuroplasticity, then, is the ability for the brain to adapt or change over time by creating new neurons and building new networks, probably like the grooves that you are talking about. Importance of neuroplasticity cannot be overstated. It means that it is possible to change dysfunctional patterns of thinking and behaving and to develop new mindsets, new memories, new skills, and new abilities. And so, Don, if the brain can be changed over time to change dysfunctional patterns of thinking and behaving and to develop these new mindsets and memories and skills and abilities they're talking about, then it can obviously happen in the reverse. That if the brain can change dysfunctional patterns, it can also develop dysfunctional patterns if one continues to use it in the same exact way and be, as you say, obsessed with, with obsessive compulsive disorders, probably another part of this, one particular topic or issue, or in this case, person. If that's all you think about in your day is how much rage you have toward a certain individual, how can it not impact the brain in that way?
Exactly, and that's what we're looking at. At this point, I'm pretty certain because it clicked, and I'm like, my wife and I looked at each other and went, oh, my God, it's neuroplasticity at work, but in a negative way.
Yeah.
So it's really, they can't get out of those ruts. They are stuck there. Mm-hmm. They're not going to change their minds because they are so convinced that they're on the right side of history. So,
well,
yeah,
you know what, you've really kind of nailed it, and thank you for the call, Don. Always good to hear from you. You've kind of underscored what I was saying earlier when I said that they could probably find something if they did a randomized controlled study. Now, you'd have to get volunteers, and the volunteers would have to be honest about Trump and agree to be studied over it, and they probably wouldn't because they would think that, you know, they would think it's stupid, you know, that they are not, there's nothing wrong with their brain, that they're rational and that they're, you know, completely cogent and you know, well-adjusted people. But if you could, I think what you just said was true. Neuroplasticity would probably be, you know, be evident here in reverse to the point where somebody's brain pre-Trump, and that's the other part. You'd have to find a way to look at brain patterns in somebody through neurological exams and brainwaves and so forth. You would have to have had some of that on file previously before Trump and then compare what someone's brain looks like and functions like prior to Trump to what it looks like now in the age of Trump and to see what TDS has done to those brains. That would be a fascinating study. Okay, let's go to Lisa in Medina. Lisa Woods. Good morning, Lisa.
Hey, good morning. Beautiful morning. Wow, what a week of weather.
Until the thunderstorms hit later on today, but yes.
I know. I thought it'd be raining when I woke up, and I was so pleased to see the sun. Yeah.
But I'll take the 71 degrees for the second straight day in a row, even if it is in the rain. That's okay.
That's right. Sure will. Hey, I wanted to throw out that Grover Norquist is coming to Northeast Ohio. He'll be coming to McDan this Saturday, and he is a heavy hitter. I realize that there's a lot of people who really know Grover Norquist from Americans for Tax Reform, but there's a lot of people that don't. And so I'm really excited to bring such a heavy hitter here to Medina.
Yeah, that is a huge get. What is he specifically going to be addressing? Maybe the $60 billion that the Inflation Reduction Act, and I use that in air quotes, pumped into the IRS to make sure they can come after every single taxpayer for every single nickel they can try to get out of them so they can send more to Volodymyr Zelensky in Ukraine?
Yeah, crazy. You know, there's just so much with the taxes. You know, he'll have a full hour or so he'll be able to hit a lot and plus take some questions as always. So it'll be really interesting.
Good deal. Yeah, yeah. I it would be a great thing to attend for me, but I think most people know that this is also an important weekend in Independence with the Bringing America Back to Life program.
Babel.
But you know what? The nice thing about Babel. On Friday, first of all, it's all day Friday and night, and then it's all day and night Saturday, too, is, you know, you could get away for an hour and a half if you wanted to go out to the McFan meeting at the Thirsty Cowboy and, you know, take in a little bit of Grover and then come on back over to Babel, because you can come and go if you are attending Bringing America Back to Life. So true conservatives who are interested in being active in all of these important things can find a way.
At this time, we can't have too many events to energize us. We need anything we could get to energize us and inform us so that we can go to battle. Because we're in a battle, and we have to be fighting now.
Believe it. Yep. Dennis made that very, very clear on Saturday night, and I knew you were there as well. So, the battle is on. It has been joined. Lisa, thank you. Enjoy Grover on Saturday.
Thank you.
Okay, appreciate you. All right, we're going to take a time out here because it's 9:55. We're going to talk about a lot of that with Kersenow coming up here in a few minutes. I didn't mention yet the part about Jamie Raskin, one of the literal most TDS-obsessed nut jobs in the Congress, has a message for the Supreme Court. After the ruling yesterday, Raskin is attempting to circumvent that court ruling and remove Trump from the ballot anyway. How? Well, we'll talk about that with Kersenow and get his thoughts on it coming up here in just a few as well. 216-901-0945-888-2-
To get a complimentary copy of Dave's book and a complimentary consultation, call 77-GAINS-4-U or MortashFinancial.com.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
This is Always Right Radio on AM 1420. The Answer is your host, Bob France.
Okay, it is hour number two now underway at 8 minutes past 10 o'clock. It is the fifth morning of the third month in the year of our Lord, 2024. Thank you so much for being with us. We got Peter Kirsten now coming up here in just a couple of minutes. We are endeavoring to make that connection. And it looks like we have made that connection. Okay, let's go ahead and bring in our good friend, Mr. Peter Kirsten now, member of the United States Commission on Civil Rights. I was going to dig that. No, can't dig that. No, can't dig that. Oh, okay. I get it. Never mind. We got a technical issue. No, it's a tech issue on this end. It's a tech issue. It's a single issue. No biggie. Let's bring in our good friend. I'll just say I can dig it when I bring in Peter Kirsten, a member of the United States Commission on Civil Rights, also a Cleveland attorney, a best-selling author, and a columnist, and a law professor. He's done just a little bit of everything, and he joins us now on AM 1420 The Answer. Hi, Pete. Good morning.
Morning, Bob. Beautiful day in Cleveland.
It is. It's going to rain, but 70 degrees on March 4th after or 5th after we had it on March 4th, too. I'll take that. Yeah, we can get by with that. All right. Hey, Peter Kirstenow, it was a beautiful day in Colorado. Well, it was a beautiful day in Washington, D.C., as it pertains to Colorado yesterday, when the Supreme Court of the United States did what I thought was kind of the most, you know, unsurprising thing that a court could do. I don't know anybody that actually expected them to uphold the Colorado Supreme Court's decision to remove Donald Trump from the ballot in that state for Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, saying he participated in insurrection. I thought everybody knew this was probably going to be a 9-0 vote, maybe 8-1 if one of the radicals decided to, play holdout. But the way the left reacted to this yesterday, Pete, was shocking. They acted stunned, like, oh, my gosh, the court just did what? The Supreme Court, David French wrote a piece saying the Supreme Court just erased part of the Constitution. Leftists everywhere lost their collective minds and said the court must be abolished. Now it's not pack the court, it's abolish the court and start all over again. They are acting like they didn't see this coming, Pete. What's going on?
Well, I think it's because they didn't see it coming because they've deluded themselves into thinking that their position was sane, and it was demonstrably insane. I think everybody who wasn't affected by Trump derangement syndrome, everybody who, you know, wasn't completely doing, you know, spinning like a top about anything Trump-related could look at this and say, this is never going to happen. The Colorado Secretary of State was out of her mind with Trump derangement syndrome. The Supreme Court justices of the Supreme Court. Now, I don't know them, and I don't want to, you know, cast aspersions on them. But when you listen to some of the commentary related to them and or the opinion itself, it was, for lack of a better term. And again, I try to have some type of collegiality comedy toward my fellow lawyers, but it was unhinged. So I was not surprised. I think a lot of people, again, as I said, if you spoke with legal scholars who don't suffer from Trump derangement syndrome, which is a real thing, I think it's almost a medical condition, frankly, medically diagnosable.
We were just discussing this. I mean, it's weird that you said that. I know you didn't have the radio on. Peter, I just talked about this with Seth the last half hour, that I think if they did a randomized controlled study, and you would have to have found people willing to volunteer to have their brain studied prior to 2015 when Trump came down the escalator, then study their brains now during this age and era of Trump, you would absolutely see profound differences in the neurological studies of their brains. TDS is a legitimate disorder that I honestly think they would find if they could study it.
It makes them do, I mean, their mantra of protecting democracy. They have such little self-reflection as a result of the Trump derangement syndrome that they don't pause to think, we're trying to prevent 180 to 200 million people from voting, you know, for the candidate of their choice by this, because they're protecting democracy. It's just the opposite. So it's a real thing. It's going to persist as long as Donald Trump is alive. And let's be frank about it. It's going to persist as long as there's a Republican who is a threat to their worldview. Donald Trump poses the most serious threat to their worldview, and one where they know, You know, look, even if there's not too much daylight between Donald Trump and some other Republican candidates when it comes to policy, the one thing that I think everyone's aware of is Donald Trump means it. When he says he's going to do A, he's going to do everything within his power and then some to do A. And that makes some people, even on the right, angry or think that he's some kind of a loon or a threat. And I bet you there are heads nodding throughout Cleveland land when I say that. But I think there are a lot of people, myself included, who've watched politics for decades and decades and realized that much of the Republican Party has been the go-along, get-along folks who only give up a little bit instead of a lot, but they are constantly giving or yielding to the Democratic Party. If you look the way we've shifted, again, during my lifetime, it's really stunning. Very often you see references made to, you know, John Kennedy, that if he were alive today, he'd be a conservative Republican. And that's true. That's absolutely true. That's how much things have shifted. But they've gone off the rails over the last, say, 8 to 9 years, maybe starting around the Clinton era, but really expanding and accelerating from Obama. And now, because there's nobody home with respect to Biden, nobody's home at the White House, the leftists who really control the mechanisms of governance have just decided they're taking over and they're pushing us in a radically left direction. Mm-hmm. So when they see institutions like the Supreme Court do what I think it was unremarkable, they lose it completely and they call for its abolition. Again, the guys who are constantly talking about threats to democracy want to abolish the Supreme Court, want to keep somebody, the preferred candidate for half of America, off the ballot. But Trump's the threat to democracy. Really amazing.
It is indeed. And the Colorado Secretary of State, I played her earlier on, literally said it's up to the American people now then, since the Supreme Court didn't do it, to go in November and save our democracy. And again, first of all, she's using that as if it's, the description of this country, which, of course, it is not. We are a constitutional representative republic. But whether she says it's a democracy or the act of democracy, which is accurate in our way of voting, they're the ones who are trying to deny people, as you point out, the right to have their choice. So now let's go into the follow up here from the Democrats, because what the court said in that 9-0 ruling is, you know, they didn't say we don't necessarily agree that Trump did not commit insurrection. What they said was is that the state, no state has the right to do this. This is something Congress would have to do. So Jamie Raskin, who is one of the most radical of the Democrat legislators in the House, said, quote, the Supreme Court punted and said it's up to Congress to act. And so I'm working with a number of my colleagues, including Debbie Wasserman Schultz and Eric Swalwell, to revive.
So that inspires confidence, doesn't it?
I know, right? Yeah, those two in particular, two of the most egregiously stupid people in Congress. But anyway, revive legislation that we had set up, that we had to set up a process by which we could determine that someone who committed insurrection is disqualified by Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Two-part question here, Pete. Number one, what do you think he and they can do? What kind of apparatus do you think he's talking about? He says they have a process that they have set up for this. And number two, I'm failing to understand how anybody can continue to use the word insurrection in a serious manner. How and why? I mean, an insurrection would be the act of literally overthrowing the government. Number one, Donald Trump was already the head of the government on January 6th of 2021. How could he insurrect himself? Number two, if they're saying he was trying to prevent the peaceful transfer of power, and that's an insurrection and an overthrow of the government. Okay, well then, why would a president who is trying to overthrow the government actually call for stronger defenses at the Capitol building where that coup was going to take place? Because he called for 10,000 National Guard troops to be present there because he knew that they were going to have a massive Stop the Steal protest rally, and that protests always invite counter-protests and that could turn ugly. So wanting to keep the peace, he asked for more security to be there and was rejected. Tell me how he can be accused of an insurrection or a coup d'etat when he literally was calling for defensive forces to stop said insurrection or coup d'etat.
Bob, you made all my points for me. Give me 1 second here. I'm just getting a phone call.
Well, you're doing a job there. I understand. It's okay.
Yeah.
You have work to do.
Yeah, the processes that they will use or try to use, but they won't have the votes to do it, probably some type of finding that the president had engaged in some type of insurrection. They will have some pro forma hearing on it, and then adduce evidence that the acts that he took on January 6th constitute an insurrection that they will define on their own terms. So that's not going to go anywhere. They don't have the votes to do that, and frankly, the cast of characters that you described are generally perceived by some of the more sane people, even the Democratic Party, as being out there. And I'm not sure in an election year that they're going to want to expose themselves like that. Some will in safe districts, and in fact, it'll be a badge of honor. With respect to the Dems, remember that in the 2016 election, talking about insurrection, remember all the things they did? I mean, Hillary Clinton was walking around in the forest with a glass of wine, muttering to herself about the fact that, you know, this is an illegitimate election and she should be the correct president. But then you had all these mechanisms that they tried to employ that we forget about because the media does not drill down on them the way they do with any act of Trump. But you may remember that they were trying to overturn the Electoral College, trying to persuade so-called faithless electors to change their vote. They were using everything they could to prevent Donald Trump in 2016, who was the legitimate winner of the election, from taking office. But nobody talks about that because 99% of the media is on the left. And that also goes to the previous question, Bob. It's more evidence that the reason why some of them are surprised at the Supreme Court decision, and nobody should have been, is because they're marinating in their leftist worldview that's reinforced by every media source. They're in a tiny little bubble, many Democrats are, where they're talking to themselves, they're reinforced by 99% of the media, and they believe that their vapid arguments, frankly, anybody on the outside who has no dog in the fight could take a look at those arguments that they make and go, this is nuts. In fact, sometimes I think some of us, I have to stand back and check myself because they're saying it so vehemently and forthrightly. What am I missing? And we're not missing anything. Their arguments are inane. They've got no constitutional or very little constitutional grounding. I mean, you can make an argument for almost anything, frankly. I can make an argument that my dogs should be president. But nonetheless, they've been immersed in this for such a long time under Trump derangement syndrome, talking to the same people, talking to themselves in a little bubble, they start doing really nutty stuff. So here we are. It's not going to end when Trump wins again, and I think he will. They're going to find something else to go after him on, and it's just remarkable that, I'll say it again, I have no special brief for Trump. I do think he was a very effective president. But nonetheless, I do think it's extraordinary when you look at it. I don't know of any other individual at least in the public sphere who could withstand the incessant assaults that they've levied against these guys. I mean, look at the fine up in New York, $300 million, and there was no damages. $300 million, and nobody was hurt. In fact, the people who supposedly were the victims were the ones who were saying, hey, everything went well. This is precisely what we wanted, and we want to do business with Trump again. It's amazing, and they're the threat to democracy. They're the threat to our current system of governance. Because they have anyone who's calling for the abolition of the Supreme Court has got a screw loose and needs to be examined very closely. And that's at least 40% of the Democratic caucus in the House.
And no question about it. Peter, you asked what they're going to do next to him. It's already being done, of course. And these, the litany of charges that they have levied against him. And he is arguing that in many of these cases, he has immunity from acts taken while president. And, of course, the question of presidential immunity is now one that, I mean, even Hugh Hewitt this morning, while celebrating the obvious 9-0, which was a given, he said, I'm not making a call on the immunity one. I don't know what the court is going to do on the presidential immunity question. So I want to discuss that with you. Here's what President Trump says, by the way, about that.
And while we're on the subject, and another thing that will be coming up very soon will be immunity for a president, and not immunity for me, but for any president. If a president doesn't have full immunity, you really don't have a president because nobody that is serving in that office will have the courage to make in many cases, what would be the right decision, or it could be the wrong decision. It could be, in some cases, the wrong decision, but they have to make decisions, and they have to make them free of all terror that can be rained upon them when they leave office or even before they leave office. And some decisions are very tough. I can tell you that as a president, that some decisions to make are very tough. I took out ISIS, and I took out some very big...
Okay, he goes on there for a little while. I'll stop it there because he's right about it being extraordinarily important for a president to be able to take actions that may be controversial without thinking that either before he leaves office or when he leaves office, he's going to be arrested for them or he's going to be charged for them. If a president's hands are tied in such ways, they can't do what needs to be done and make tough calls. So do you have a clear thought on what you think the court will do with respect to the presidential immunity question?
Well, the court has laid out certain parameters in cases beforehand. And again, as I say quite often, I don't purport to be an expert on these things, but I play one on the radio. But I've looked at this on several occasions. And at least with respect to the precedent on this, precedent's fairly clear, and it's for the reasons that Trump articulated, that you can't have a president who is hamstrung by his political opponents and thereby potentially, in many cases, not just discharge the duties for which he was elected, but could place the safety of Americans in jeopardy. You know, we've had at least two major cases. Remember Clinton versus Jones with respect to Bill Clinton being sued by Paula Jones. Mm-hmm. But the one that probably has more impact on official duties, of course, is Nixon versus Fitzgerald, where, again, under Article 2, Section 3, and kind of the penumbra that surrounds it, the way the Supreme Court likes to use that term, the kind of you have to look not just at the words but the surrounding intent. The president has absolute immunity from civil actions for all acts, you know, within the penumbra of his official duties. And this is so he doesn't have to, as Trump indicated, be looking over his shoulder and second-guessing himself constantly, because a lot of the things he has to do have to be done at a split second. You know, if he's going to push a button, for example, he can't be dithering and saying to himself, geez, you know, maybe I'll get sued or maybe I'll be indicted for this. But it's got limitations, you know, at least with respect to certain acts, criminal acts, for example. It doesn't require a stay of all actions, at least for private conduct, provided it doesn't impede his official duties. So, you know, the president has to have considerable latitude to act, and I think the court recognizes that. And again, this goes to the fact that these folks on the other side of the political aisle are looking for everything and anything that they can throw at a president. I mean, you know, look, Obama arguably could have been indicted or sued or something with respect to some of the drone strikes that he had, one of which killed an American citizen. But we understand that the president, the enormity of the office, requires that there be considerable space and latitude for the chief executive of the United States of America, who is the commander in chief of the armed forces, to act in a way that he's not looking over his shoulder. He has to sometimes act instantaneously. If he has to push a button, if there's some, you know, threat to America, he can't be sitting there going like, oh my goodness, I'm going to end up in the electric chair for doing this.
Yeah.
So I think this goes back to what we were talking about a little bit before. The left, I think, is so immersed in get Trump that it's clouding their broader view of what happens if we set a precedent that could somehow hamstring our favorite candidate or any candidate. That's the thing. This is about the United States of America, not Trump. And when you start having the, you know, directing your conduct and your actions toward one specific individual, then it's going to compromise the ability of all of the United States of America and our government to discharge its duties in the manner in which the founders had anticipated. So, you know, just step back, think about America, just like that Colorado Secretary of State who doesn't see the irony in trying to prevent 200 million people from voting for their preferred candidate because of a threat to democracy. That's just the most hilarious thing. If Saturday Night Live was still funny, they'd have a skit about that.
Peter Kirstenow is with us on AM 1420, The Answer. We're going to take a break here. We're going to come back, and we're going to talk about voting in 2024 and why the Attorney General Merrick Garland is using the DOJ to bring back the methods and the apparatus for committing election fraud. He declared so in Selma on Sunday. We're going to talk to Pete about that. And then also, what we haven't talked about yet this week, the University of Florida fired the entire DEE department and staff at the university per new state law. Governor DeSantis continues to kill it down there. Florida is now DEI.
230-5174.
Giving you reason in the age of unreason. Always Right Radio with Bob France and The Answer.
All right, let's continue now at 10:35 on this Tuesday. It's a Kirstenow day. It's a great day. Clearly, we get to tap into the wisdom and experience of Peter Kirstenow, member of the United States Commission on Civil Rights and longtime Cleveland attorney. Okay, Pete, so all of the signs point to a shift in power in November, including the revelation on Sunday of the most recent New York Times poll. And it's important that it's the New York Times for obvious reasons. It shouldn't be considered that way, but it is, because people will say if it's Rasmussen, well, that's a conservative organization. They're going to do a push poll. You can't trust it. This is the New York Times. New York Times says Trump 48, Biden 43. More importantly, New York's Time poll says that the plurality of voters say that Biden's policies made their lives worse, as opposed to Trump's policies, which made their lives better. This is a New York Times poll, if I didn't underscore that part. Moreover, a plurality of the, or not a plurality of the voters in this case, but by a count of 43 to 33, the individuals who were surveyed voted last time. And 43 to 33, that's a 10-point margin, they were Biden voters last time. So, in other words, there is a huge shift coming from Biden to Trump based on policies, not personality, based on some of the things, again, that made their lives better under Trump and not so much under Joe Biden. So all of this evidence leads us to two conclusions. One, that they have to try to defeat him in the courts since they realize they can't beat him at the ballot box. Or two, we have to find a way to steal it at the ballot box. Which brings us to Merrick Garland. The attorney general said at a church, a black church in Selma yesterday, that his Department of Justice is going to make it their mission to bring back mail-in voting and make it available to everyone, to bring back ballot drop boxes, the same kind that were used and abused, as evidenced by the movie by Dinesh D'Souza, 2,000 Mules, and to make sure that these terribly unfair and racist-driven voter ID mandates are lifted, because, you know, as you know, as a black man, it's really easy for me to get a driver's license or an ID, but not you. Peter Kirstenow, what role will the DOJ have in what happens in November?
Well, unfortunately, unless the Republicans, and again, it's unfortunate that we conservatives need to depend upon the Republican Party to defend the Republic. But the Republicans need to be vigilant, make sure we've got all the systems in place and personnel in place to make sure that the election is not compromised. You know, that poll is really remarkable. When you look at the fact that Trump has a lead in almost every category, and a substantial one by presidential terms, over Biden, considering the wall-to-wall, the uniform media support and frankly, covering for Biden over the last 3.5 years, and their universal disdain and, frankly, lying about Trump over the last 3.5 years, what you can't do, or what the Democrats can't do, is make people imagine that what they're paying for at the pump is lower than what it is. Same with grocery prices. They can't wave away the wars that are going on across the world as a direct result of, I mean, we talked about the invasion of Ukraine. I identified precisely when Putin made the decision that he's going to go in, when then Biden basically said in a press conference that, well, it depends on whether it's a big invasion or a small. I'm just kind of paraphrasing, but whether it's a bigger invasion or a small invasion as to what kind of action he would take. Extraordinary stuff. The incompetence of this president is stratospheric, but they've got to, Merrick Garland and the Democrats know, that given the figures that you just cited, and again, you're right, it's New York Times, but you look at every other poll, they're almost about the same. There isn't any real divergence. New York Times is expressing precisely what's going on. They can do one of two things, meaning the Democrats. One is employ all the mechanisms that you've just described. Merrick Garland, you know, using, you know, insisting upon no voter ID, none of the safeguards protecting the integrity of the election, just as we had with COVID. Now, those systems were placed put into place ostensibly because of COVID. We don't have COVID anymore, any realistic element of COVID. So we knew this was going to happen. We had predicted that once they instituted these policies, they would insist upon them because they are rife with the potential for fraud and abuse, and that's what we're going to be seeing. They know that. They cannot win if they do not affect the mechanisms of the election. Or, number two, the only other way is to drop Biden and put somebody else in there. And the only person right now, based on the polls that I've seen, I think this makes sense intuitively, we've talked about it, is for them to somehow coronate Michelle Biden. And that's what it would be. It would be a coronation. You can expect the media to do a swoon the likes of which we've never seen in the world. She'd never be challenged on anything. Remember, she's never really had a real job. I don't think she really wants it, but I am fearful of the fact that they may pull that stunt because she'll be insulated from criticism by all in the media. I don't know how effective that's going to be these days because I think a lot of people have gotten wise to this. But nonetheless, she will be seen as being the smartest person in the history of the world, the most compassionate person in the history of the world. So they only have two things they can do. They've got to loosen the integrity, the protections that protect the integrity of an election, or come up with somebody other than Biden. More and more people are thinking, are doing a 180 on whether or not they'll drop Biden. I think that, you know, some people are saying, well, it's not really possible, and Biden himself doesn't want to drop out. He believes he's a great president, and he wants to be a two-term president. I think Joe Biden does, too. So who knows what's going to happen? But the potential for replacement is there. The certainty of them messing around with the election integrity provisions is there. And just with respect to, it's insulting, for example, as we all know, it infantilizes all Americans, but particularly Black Americans, that somehow Black Americans can't obtain a photo ID, that somehow, because of this incredibly racist and discriminatory country, it's impossible to get a photo ID. Now, I mean, that's the most inane statement ever, but the media and Democrats, but I repeat myself, continue to pursue that angle. And as I think I've mentioned on the show, Bob, before, we've had a couple of hearings on the Civil Rights Commission because we do deal with voting rights at the Civil Rights Commission. It's one of the principal areas of our concern. I still remember vividly one hearing we had, oh boy, it was 15, 20 years ago, where we had a number of minorities, you know, Blacks, American Indians, Native Americans, so on and so forth, and we asked about whether they had any problems producing identification. And I'll just skip right. I mean, the part of the responses were spectacularly funny because nobody's putting up with this bull crap except for those who are invested in perpetuating the narrative, meaning Democratic operatives.
Sure.
But it's an insult to Blacks and others who they claim are too infantile to, oh, how do I get a photo ID? Oh, my goodness. Well, I asked this one woman, I'd say she was probably in her late 50s, Black woman, in her late 50s, and she was from Georgia, whether or not she found it difficult to get photo ID. And of course, she looked at me as if I was nuts. And then I said, do you have any photo ID? And she actually reached down, picked out her purse, pulled out about four or five different means of identification with her photograph on there. And anyway, we did a further analysis of this. We did more of a statistical analysis in addition to adducing physical evidence. But what we found is that minority voters are more likely to have a photo ID than whites or upper middle class voters of any racial group. because that demographic needs to access or does access more government programs that require photo ID. So she pulled out all these photo IDs out of her purse, many more than I have, and they were for different programs and different reasons, you know, not all government reasons, but there's photo ID there. The fact is that more photo ID is available to blacks than anybody. It's as if they're saying blacks are on the planet Saturn and can't get to the local DMV to get a photo ID. This is just nuts on steroids. And Republicans need to push back hard and call the Democrats the racists that they are for even suggesting that. They won't stop and won't shut up. Republicans cannot yield to this, and we have to at least put into the minds of the public the truth. That is that Democrats lie, cheat, and steal in order to win elections. And we've known that for a long time, but we cannot back down and have to continue to voice it because they never back down.
Yeah, and great analysis, Pete. And, you know, first of all, I did want to respond to the Michelle Obama portion of what you just discussed. It was this morning. Former First Lady Michelle Obama's office addressed rumors that she plans to run for president Tuesday morning. Quote, as former First Lady Michelle Obama has expressed several times over the years, she will not be running for president, end quote, said Crystal Carson, director of communications for the former First Lady's office. Mrs. Obama supports President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris's reelection campaign. Michelle previously told Oprah Winfrey, quote, politics is hard, and the people who get into it, you've got to want it. It's got to be in your soul because it's so important. It's not in my soul, end quote. You still think, Pete, that she might rise up and replace him?
Absolutely, yeah.
You think all that's a smokescreen?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I do. I don't, you know, whether she does it or not is an open question. I don't know that it's definite, but I do think that that was a bunch of bull that we just heard. I think that if the pathway exists, and I think it does exist, I think for political reasons, she doesn't want to come out against the incumbent president. They saw, meaning the Democrats, saw what happens when you've got an intra-party challenge to a sitting president. Look at Jimmy Carter, for example. It hurts the prospects of a president, but it's also, to a large extent, hurts the challenger. You look at what it did to Ted Kennedy, because he has a taint about him in terms of his party loyalty, whatever it may be. There are a host of reasons that, frankly, are beyond my ken. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I do think that people within the Democratic Party at the highest levels are maneuvering and making sure that they can have a replacement for Joe Biden. I think their preferred replacement would be Michelle Obama, because she's the only one who looks like she has the type of support that might be able to defeat Trump. And again, she would be insulated from any form of criticism whatsoever at all, just as she has been her entire career. But there are other potential challengers. I think that Gavin Newsom, every time he says that he's not running and says how great Biden is practically telegraphing, screaming from the rooftops, please, please, please nominate me. So I don't believe any of these folks. Again, why you would believe political Democrats, not rank-and-file people that you work with, why you would ever believe political Democrats and their handmaidens in the media is beyond me when we've had decades of evidence to show that when they say A, they mean B.
Yeah, well, and you're right. She can't come out and say, well, of course I would consider it if asked, you know, because you're right. That does undermine the confidence in the court. But today's Super Tuesday. Doesn't all of that change at the end of the day today? Or does it have to be at the Democratic National Convention? At what point would it be considered too late for them to make a switch?
I don't think for Michelle Obama it would ever be too late. But the mechanisms of the electoral process require that somebody get geared up. You know, they can't wait too long. This is a huge nation, and it's the presidential election. They have to have systems in place. They've got to be able to, you know, get their troops out there. So, you know, some people talked about, and you've probably seen all the articles where people are speculating as to how it would happen. Would it happen at the convention? Would he release his delegate? You know, all these different mechanisms. And we're going to see more and more theories along those lines. Clearly, the sooner the better from the standpoint of the prospects of the Democrats. The sooner the better. But by the same token, if they were to do it at the convention, they'd only have a couple of months in which to campaign. That cuts two ways. It depends on who the candidate is. If it's Michelle Obama, I think it's probably a good thing. because it exposes her to even less time for the Republicans to mount a challenge or to, you know, develop their campaign against her. And she's a known commodity. At least her policy positions aren't necessarily known, but you presume they're the same as Barack Obama's, if not even more to the left. So they could do it there. For someone who isn't at that level, and that's almost every other candidate on the Democratic side, it would have to happen sooner. They'd have to have some type of mechanism by which the name recognition would be elevated, by which they could do the, you know, the mechanics of actually making the switch. That would be a harder prospect, and I think that time is running out there. But Michelle Obama stays viable to the very end.
Peter Kirsenow, continuing with us on AM 1420, The Answer. Michelle, viable to the end. All right, we're going to bank that because I did an extensive interview with Joel Gilbert, who wrote a book and made a documentary about it, about how Michelle Obama is going to be the one in 2024, no matter how late it comes. So you are not alone in your thinking there, Peter. I want to pivot quickly to the University of Florida. They eliminated all positions focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion, and halted their DEI-related contracts on Friday. 13 full-time positions were terminated. 15 administrative appointments were ended for faculty members. First of all, I cannot believe they have that many people focused on this nonsense. The Florida state government has escalated a years-long battle to regulate how race and gender are addressed in its educational institutions. Earlier this year, the Board of Education announced a new rule banning public colleges from using any federal funds for DEI programs, activities, and policies. So the University of Florida said terminating the DEI positions is to comply with the Florida Board of Governors regulation on prohibited expenditures. So this is just huge. Christopher Rufo said the conservative counter-revolution has begun. This has to be just the first of many, many more to fall. What is your takeaway from Florida's following? It shouldn't be a big deal to follow the law, but they're following the law, and a lot of people wish they were not.
Yeah, and you know, I think, first of all, I love the idea of getting rid of anything related to DEI because it is the font of discrimination and racism in the country today, which was well on its way to being extinct before DEI raised its head. I think it is such a pernicious doctrine. It makes people count on the basis of race or based on the basis of identity. There's an element of me, the conservative in me, that says I'm not sure that I like the idea that there was a law mandating this. I like the idea of freedom to do whatever you want to do, and that includes colleges to employ whatever mechanisms they are, whatever they want to teach, within limits, I think, but those limits have to be extraordinarily broad so that you can pursue truth and information without any kind of strictures. But the substance of this, I like the idea of getting rid of DEI. Again, don't know if the mechanism is the appropriate one, but DEI is harmful to our society. It is dividing people on the basis of personal characteristics. It's the worst thing possible. I'm not sure that any of this, based on the DEI programs I've seen, have any pedagogical value whatsoever, or even arguable. It's simply ideology on steroids, and it's a Marxist ideology. This is something that the short life of DEI, and using that acronym, has only been in fashion for just maybe a little bit more than a decade. It's been in place in some fashion for a long, long time. It's had such a pernicious influence on society in general. We're supposed to be one America, and here we are separating people on the basis of immutable characteristics. The worst thing, it's the antithesis of Martin Luther King's judging people on the basis of the content of their character versus the color of their skin or any other physical characteristic. So I applaud the outcome in Florida. I'm not exactly convinced that this is the way of going about it. But Ron DeSantis is a smart constitutional conservative. I'm sure he had his law department take a good hard look at it to make sure that it's appropriate and it doesn't have implications for when a Democrat comes in and wants to do something similar that might or might not be constitutional. But either way, the outcome, the result is one that I think all Americans should applaud. Someone needs to tell me what has gotten better in America since the advent of DEI programs. I mean, I really would like to know that. I'm on the Civil Rights Commission. We've looked at these things for quite some time. You know, I've looked at it probably longer than anybody because, again, as I've told you, Bob, if you want to know what's going to happen in the United States of America 5 years from now, come to the Civil Rights Commission hearing today because that's where the left tries out all of their schemes. So we've seen this for quite some time. I'm glad we can start to get rid of it. This has done just almost unimaginable damage to the body politic in America. Look at how divisive.
Pete, let me jump in on this now, if I may, only because we're running out of time, and I've got one more question for you. So, if you don't mind, Thursday night, Joe Biden is going to give an address, and it's going to start out with the state of our union is blank. I want you to tell me how he will fill in that blank, and then I want you to tell me how you would fill in that blank. Peter Kirsten.
Well, that's a very good question. I'd like to ask a lot of people that. I think he's going to do what is typically done. The State of the Union is strong, but I'm not sure in my lifetime it's ever been weaker. During the late 60s, you might argue that there were a lot of problems that we had, but these problems we have today are existential, and that's not an exaggeration. And again, I resort to our friend Victor Davis Hanson, who I think is brilliant on these things, and he's got the longitudinal look at these things, and he's very concerned that the United States of America may not continue to exist if we continue down this path for not that much longer. So much of the institutions that hold up the United States of America are flailing about. We don't have confidence in those institutions for good reason. We've got just look at the Jamie Raskins of the world and the nutty things that they're doing, or the Secretary of State in Colorado. These are things that threaten the integrity of the republic, and they're always talking about threats to democracy. What a complete joke and utter fiction that is. Most of the people who are saying that are the true threats to democracy, true threats to the United States of America, and Joe Biden is going to probably go through a laundry list of things that he's done to so-called strengthen democracy and the livelihoods of people in the United States of America, none of which will be true. And the problem for him is this. He's been insulated for 4 years by a fawning mainstream media. That's where there's been some cracks now. But he's been insulated so much that he doesn't realize that ordinary Americans can spot, crap when they hear it. And with him, you get a lot of crap. So I think he runs the risk of saying things that just aren't so, and people are going to be incensed by it or not going to be happy about it at all. But, the damage probably is not going to be that great, because I think a lot of people have already taken the measure of him. And number two is, I'm not sure a lot of people are going to be watching the State of the Union. The only reason many people are going to watch is to see whether he falls down or whether he mumbles or just does some. Seriously.
They're going to give him a shot of B12 before he goes out there. They're going to give him whatever energy they can.
Whatever it is
so,
they're doing,
But
that doesn't seem to be working the way it was before. If you've noticed, his public appearances have gotten more and more troublesome.
Yeah.
I don't know if they need to up his medication a little bit or whatever they're doing, but clearly they do something to him whenever he has big events, because otherwise he's falling down, he's mumbling, he's going in the wrong direction. But it's I will watch just because out of the suspense. What is he going to do? Will he be able to make it all the way through? I think they will. They'll probably let him sleep all day long. And that's not. I'm fine. That's okay. And I think that's true that he's going to do that. And I'm not faulting, but that's probably what they're going to do. This is a big deal. It's an election year. They have to make sure he doesn't blow himself up in spectacular fashion on national television.
Well, it'll be very, very interesting to watch if he does. It may be must-see TV, but not for the reasons that Democrats hope. But it should be interesting to see what he does. Peter Kirsten out. Terrific analysis on all points. Thank you, my friend. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Bob.
All right. That's Kirsten out. It's 10:57. We are
AM 1420 has been Cleveland's answer for news, celebrating 100 years in Cleveland. This hour of Always Right Radio is brought to you by The Floor King and KeepingMedicareSimple.com.
You and I know and do not believe that life is so dear and peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. If nothing in life is worth dying for, when did this begin? Just in the face of this enemy? Or should Moses have told the children of Israel to live in slavery under the Pharaohs? Should Christ have refused the cross? Should the patriots at Concord Bridge have thrown down their guns and refused to fire the shot heard round the world? The martyrs of history were not fools. And our honored dead, who gave their lives to stop the advance of the Nazis, didn't die in vain. Where then is the road to peace? Well, it's a simple answer after all. You and I have the courage to say to our enemies, there is a price we will not pay. There is a point beyond which they must not advance.
This is Always Right Radio with Bob France on on AM 1420, The Answer.
It is exactly that at 8 minutes after 11 o'clock. Good morning to you. Thank you so much for staying with us. Great stuff by Peter Kirsanoff. If you missed that conversation, you should rectify that situation by listening to it later. After the show ends, about an hour after the show ends, it'll all be uploaded to you and available at whkradio.com. whkradio.com. Just busy poking fun at Seth over here for a couple of minutes. He looks like a 90-year-old woman getting ready to play canasta with some of the other old biddies at the home, wearing those ladies' glasses over there.
Yeah.
They couldn't have given you a kind made for a man?
Well, I mean, I had to get my own. I'm taking drops because I got a little iron thing going on.
Uh-huh. And you chose the ladies'
glasses. Well, I went to Drug Mart last night because they have everything you need.
That's true. They do. But including ladies' glasses for grown men.
I couldn't find a men's pair that had the right strength that I need. And so now I'm wearing these, like, they're like brown and black kind of patterned women's glasses.
Yeah, and they're fantastic. I mean, they really set off your eyes nicely.
See, yeah, they are beautiful. Yeah. I appreciate that.
All I could think of when I saw you come in with those, by the way, is was one thing, and that was this.
May I have one of those, madam?
Madam? What do you call me, madam?
For? Ladies' glasses. Yes. Look here, see, it's right here. Yeah. Gloria Vanderbilt collection.
You sold me ladies' glasses.
You are George Costanza.
I am.
You are. You are absolutely, and I'd like to know if that says Gloria Vanderbilt in the inside. By the way, you now have a new nickname, Gloria. That's going to be a thing.
Well, they're actually not very expensive. They're like $5.
I don't care. They'd be the knockoff Gloria.
Yeah, Vanderbilt.
So they probably say on the inside Gloria Handerbilt or something.
Yeah. And then the messed up thing is that, like, I was putting them on to look at the screen here.
Yeah.
And I poked myself in the good eye with the. The glasses, the arm of the glasses.
Now, I can't see out of both eyes. What'd you do to yourself anyway?
What, as far as the eye goes?
Yeah.
I have no idea. They just looked, it's been like red and kind of watery for like a couple of days.
You know, there's an old saying, it's an old cliche, and I don't know if it's true or not, but there's some kind of a sin that they say will make you go blind.
Yeah.
Is that happening here? Is that,
I would have been blind years ago. I've been married for like 20 years. I would have been blind long ago.
Oh, my goodness. Seth, there is only one of you, and we are all very thankful of that. All right, 216-901-0945 and 888-281-1110. So I've got a interesting story here that I was going to talk about on Monday yesterday, but I did not get to. But I really think is worth our time a little bit. Tonight, first of all, I have an event coming up tonight. It is a free speech summit that is going to be put on by my friends and colleagues at Citizens for Free Speech. And we're going to, Alex Newman and Patrick Wood and Mary Baker and I and myself, we're going to be covering all of the, you know, latest threats to the First Amendment. And they are really coming from a lot of different places, from our government to the tech lords that decide what we see and we cannot see. And by the way, speaking of tech too, Seth, is Facebook and Instagram still down?
That's what I'm reading. Tens of thousands of reports all across the country about Facebook and Instagram down.
And there's a lot of speculation about that, by the way, as to it's on Super Tuesday. Are they trying to, I mean, if Super Tuesday were a regular Super Tuesday, I might be more apt to question the legitimacy of this as just, you know, some sort of a glitch and not a hack. But, you know, who's there to vote for? And really, who's there to vote for? There's nobody opposing Biden. Only Nikki Haley remains there with Trump, and that's just, you know, a figurehead thing. She's not a serious candidate or choice. So it's, I just did a full hour with Peter Kirsanoff. We never mentioned Super Tuesday. Never mention it because it's not an issue. It's like, who's going to win Iowa, or not Iowa, but who's going to win, you know, any of the, you know, what are the 14, 15 states plus one territory voting? Who's going to win this one, that one? How many delegates? Blah, blah. It doesn't matter because it's all over anyway. So I don't think it's one of those hacks trying to disrupt Super Tuesday. I just got a text message from somebody who said that's what they think is going on. And I don't think so, personally. But with respect to tech, I don't... Well, Seth, what did you say? You were pointing out that this is the second interesting interruption of sorts in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, we had the cell phone thing go down with the different carriers where you couldn't get service, and people were freaking out about that.
Yeah, and millions of those.
And, of course, they blamed it on a tech issue.
Right.
And then, now you got Facebook and Instagram, a couple of the biggest tech companies out there going down. And, I think, personally, it could maybe be a dry run for some of these maybe illegals that are coming over on a way to attack this country. And you do a dry run, they're not going to tell you it's a terror attack or anything like that. They're going to tell you it's some guy in the office.
Well, make the connection for me. How would the tech glitching or hacking or whatevering impact the illegals on the ground?
Well, I'm saying that it's some of those people coming in that are doing maybe, the hacking themselves.
Oh, well, but they don't have to come in to do that. No, I mean, maybe not, the cyber hackers from China have been wreaking havoc on the world forever from China. I mean, it's the internet is in the dark web is...
Might be easier to do it when you're closer to it, that's all.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I think more, when you bring up accurately the... What was it, AT&T and T-Mobile, and I think those were the two big ones that went down on the cell phone day, which is about a week. Wasn't it last Tuesday? Was it exactly a week apart? Maybe?
I'll have to look that up, but it was close.
But that freaked a lot of people out. And now this, the largest, people, most of us talk about Twitter as being like the national public square, but Twitter is still a distant second to Facebook in terms of overall users. Facebook is still king. And if Facebook and Facebook's co-property, Instagram, are both down, that's massive. That affects, millions and millions of users here in the United States and around the world.
It's February 23rd.
So, I didn't ask you what date it was. I asked if it was a week ago.
It was about a week ago.
Thanks for that.
I'm not that smart.
So it was a little more than that. So that was a Friday. That was two Fridays ago. Because a week ago was the 27th. So it was a week and a half ago, technically. So not exactly the same. But the point being, two really interesting massive tech outages in a week and a half period. I think about EMP stuff more than I do hackers. Is this... Let's see how the Americans react to being without their cell phones for a few hours. Let's see how Americans react and what their capabilities are if we take away their online platforms for a few hours. And once they kind of see what the... I'm totally 1,000% making this up. This is guesswork. I'm just telling you things that I think about, things that I fear. I'm not saying this is what's going on, but it's what I can envision. Before detonating an EMP, for those who don't know, electromagnetic pulse bombs essentially would be able to knock out virtually all electronics at the same time within a massive range, depending on the size of the EMP, which would mean your phones, including landline phones too, cars because of the electrical and electronics that make the engines run. Your computers, literally anything and everything, if it's got electronics in it or is battery driven or anything of that nature, it would be inoperable. So you'd be stuck where you are unless you have a horse or a bicycle, or your feet. There would be no transportation of goods. Trucks couldn't bring food to your grocery store, which means you wouldn't be able to get food from there. If you could ride your bike there, or at least in short order, because everybody would descend immediately like mad jackals. I'd be one of them, I suppose. The only people who'd be in good shape right now would be the Amish. You'd be standing off to the side going, because they don't need any of it. They don't use any of that stuff, and they are good to go. And I can only imagine, and I hope they're prepared to defend themselves, because people would be coming for that just for survival. Anyway, I feel like before they would detonate something big like that, they would do it in little segments and say, let's take this away. Let's see how they respond. Let's take that away. Let's see how they respond. Okay, we need to shore up this one. We need to hit them harder on this aspect because they had an answer for that one and so forth. EMP is my wife's biggest and most terrifying potential attack. It's not a nuclear bomb. It's not, you know, a full-out invasion, which we're kind of enduring right now. It's the EMP because, you know, if you've got kids particularly who are, you know, not living with you anymore, you know, we got a kid in Pennsylvania, we got another one in Tennessee, and no way to communicate with them, no way to provide for them, no way to protect them, no way to say, hey, go here, go there, do this, do that to survive. They would be on their own like you are and we are, and that's her biggest fear.
Well, I was going to say the same thing about my wife. It would be her biggest fear that, you know, one of these EMP things would happen. The problem is that she would have to actually talk to me. So then she'd be on her own because we'd be divorced. She likes to sit on her phone and look at everything on Instagram and Facebook. While, you know,
that's
we're
a different
home.
Kind of threat.
Totally
so.
Different kind of threat, but she'd be done for. Like, because we'd actually have to sit there and talk to each other, and that would never happen. So
we yeah. who was the EMP guest that we had on the TV show on Strictly Speaking?
Oh, God.
I want to say Steve.
No.
Was it
Charles?
I'm trying. Was it Michael Heberling?
Heberling. No. No, that was the electric guy.
Oh, he was on electric vehicles, EVs.
Anyway, William Fortune.
Oh, William Fortune. Yes, thank you. That was a really eye-opening episode. If you don't know what we're talking about, Strictly Speaking, my TV show that airs on True Blue, which you can go to watchtrueblue.com and subscribe if you'd like to watch all of these. We got 50, 60 episodes or something like that right now. And one of them we did was a full hour plus with William Forstin, who is an expert on EMPs and how they work and what the real threat would be and what it would look like. He wrote a book, in fact, called, like, you know, The Seconds After or something like that. It was really, really just a terrifying look at what would happen here. I mean, essentially, he predicted that some 90% of the population would be dead within, you know, like a week. I can't remember specifically, but because that was an earlier recorded episode. But if you want to go to watchtrueblue.com, and we replay older episodes as well on their free fast channels on Roku and Plex and TCL TV. But watch True Blue. Just no E's on True or Blue. Just TRUBLU, and you can see it for yourself. But the EMP threat is a legitimate thing that I think I kind of agree with my wife. If we are all going to die in an attack from whatever foreign source would detonate an EMP or detonate something, if we are, if death is imminent, it's going to happen. I would rather have it be a nuclear blast where you're essentially turned to dust in less than a millisecond, or something like that, than the terror and trauma of starving to death, trying to find a way to contact and get in touch with and help and aid and protect your loved ones and so forth in an EMP type of scenario where the world is just, that used to be connected, is now completely disconnected, where I would be in my driveway. Or what if we're here on the job, you know? I mean, how far away are you from your work? Is your commute 30 minutes by car? If your commute is 30 minutes into Cleveland or wherever by car, what is it by foot? Because that's how you're getting back, unless you can steal a bicycle from somebody. And even if you do, if somebody is going to try to steal it from you, the worst elements of human survival, well, let me rephrase, human survival and the desire for it would bring out the worst elements of humanity, because you would take from anybody in order to survive yourself or to help your family survive. That's why it's, so the EMP to me would be more traumatic, would be more of a drawn out death, would be more painful, would be more torturous. You'd have to commit acts that you had never thought you would do. But if you see your little baby over here crying and starving to death, and you see somebody else feeding their baby over there, you're gonna take some of that. You're going to ask nicely, will you share? And if not, will you take it from another baby's mouth to put it in your baby's? Do you understand what I mean? And there's no right answers to these. Well, maybe there are, but I wouldn't want to have to face them. That's what EMP makes me think of. And so Facebook and Instagram's down. The cell phones were down a week and a half ago. What's next? What happens when just broadband goes out? What happens when dare I say this, if they can do it to certain internet platforms, they can do it to cell phones, why can they not shut down all radio transmitters? And you can't hear this show or any other. And you're looking for information. You're begging for somebody to tell you what's going on and when it's over and what to do in the event of an emergency. You turn your radio on when there's a tornado siren. You turn your radio on when there is, you get alerted when there's an Amber Alert. I mean, you know, do this. Be on the lookout for that. There's always somebody helping. What about when all of that is silent and you are now on your own? Find food, grow food, kill food, make food, something. You're on your own and there's no communication anywhere. That's as bad as it would get for me. Well, we might have to do a whole show on this here. Might have to bring William Forstgen onto the radio side. Might have to take calls on it. I don't know. 217, that isn't the story I wanted to tell, by the way. And I wanted to tell a story about Elon Musk because I was starting to get into the platforms. Elon Musk, who has brought back free speech to Twitter, isn't necessarily committing to free speech to Twitter anymore. Now he says if you target individuals repeatedly with misgendering them, using dead names or pronouns, Twitter will not necessarily suspend your account, but they will make you invisible or less visible to other accounts. In other words, those who monetize, those whose careers are made on number of clicks and interactions that they have online would lose all of that. So Elon suddenly making a pivot toward the left when it comes to a free speech fight that he had taken on from the beginning and spending $40 billion of his own dollars to buy that platform. So that was the story I was going to get to. If you're on hold, we'll come to you right after this. If you're not on hold, you can get there at 216-901-0945, 888-281-1110. You tell me, what's a bigger threat to you, your opinion, a nuclear bomb or an EMP? You tell me which one you would rather have happen. I can think of really, really strong arguments on both sides, but I've made my call. I would rather...
Gift. Enlightening the sleeping masses and stoking the fire of the American dream. Always Right Radio with Bob France. The Answer.
Okay, final segment now at 11:33. Appreciate you being with us on AM 1420. The Answer. You got something to say? You can say it. I'm asking the question. Vaporized or nuclear? EMP. Which one is worse? Again, stipulating that death is imminent, which one would be worse? I'd rather the vaporization. Oh, wait, why hang around and suffer to death? I'm not a fan. Joe in Westlake. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
Bob, if there's a nuclear attack, they are going to open with EMPs. That'll be the first thing they do, you know, to try to take down defenses. So it's going to be both.
Why would they, hey Joe, in your opinion, why would they need the nuke if they detonate the EMPs? And what our my guest that I had on, the expert, you know, kind of did all of the you know, the potential ramifications and so forth, said essentially 90% of humanity would be wiped out in very, very short order anyway. Why run the risk of nuclear fallout, you know, nuclear winter, if you don't have to, if you can just use the EMP and essentially kill people off that way?
Once an EMP is a nuclear device, once a nuclear device detonates over the U.S., they're launching. You know, that's the policy. You know, that's mutually assured destruction. So it's going to be a, you know.
So you think if they determine that, say, an EMP is detonated over the United States and a portion of the United States is indeed rendered completely, you know, inoperable because of that, that the U.S. would launch actual nuclear weapons at you know, say, let's say it's China, at Beijing.
Yes, they would, without a doubt. An EMP is a nuclear weapon. Because think about this. You know, an EMP goes off, that knocks off your communication system, your electrical infrastructure. What's your assumption going to be? Your assumption is that was an attempt to take down your command and control system,
sure,
to prepare for the next wave. So you're going to have 15 minutes to decide what are you going to do. And they already know the answer, which is to respond. That's why
Oh no, they would definitely respond. I'm not really talking about the American response. I'm just saying, just as a person, if you're going to get killed one way or the other, I mean, you're just saying they would both come. And I get that an EMP is a nuclear device, but it is detonated, above the land. You know, like, you know, I don't know exactly how many thousands of feet in the air, but it's detonated over an area, and then it disables everything beneath that particular radius that it has, depending on the size of the EMP and the range. Whereas a traditional nuclear weapon, like the atomic bombs we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they detonated just, you know, like 100 feet off the ground. And, of course, it vaporized everything within the radius of its blast. So, I mean, yes, they're both nuclear, but one is a different type of detonation and a different type of explosion and would provide a different type of death, I suppose, right?
Yeah, but governments aren't going to differentiate about that. I mean, it could be a dirty bomb. It could be an EMP. Whatever, if you go nuclear against a government, the outcome of that is not going to be a positive.
No, of course not, because we would, we would reply accordingly. Yes, and I agree with you, and I would be calling for that. We've all known this for a long time during the Cold War. You know, neither one wanted to be the first one to fire because the other one is going to fire, and then the bombs are going to cross each other in the air. The missiles are going to cross each other and pass each other in the air, and like you said, it's mutual assured destruction. So you're right, of course, how our response would be. I'm just worried about I'm wondering what we would want here as people, though. As far as the first strike that we received, what would we prefer?
Oh, well, it going out in a flash is certainly better. By the way, take a look at the WJPerryProject.org. That is a anti-nuclear weapon initiative by former Secretary of Defense William J. Perry. Like most scholars of government, he has been, you know, explaining that we are now in an unstable arms race. We have been for years, and where this is going is nuclear war. We have NATO expansion. We have proxy wars in multiple areas.
Yeah.
There is no monetary or political motivation in D.C. to stop this behavior. It's running out of control. And Putin just last week said that if NATO helps Ukraine, he's going to respond with nuclear weapons to the countries that sent the troops. So this is a very real issue.
Yeah, I don't buy it, though, for the same reason I just described. He knows the moment he does that the other NATO nations that are not struck are going to launch at Moscow. And they're going to think, everybody knows that if you use one of these, there is going to be one coming the other direction. And you're going to assure your own destruction as well. That's been one defining thing that we all know that we can agree on. That's why the Cold War remained what it was.
It's the same thing as the Cuban Missile Crisis. You don't have to actually launch a weapon. All you have to do is roll up to the border of another country with a nuclear missile. Once you're within certain range, that's dangerous enough.
They'll
take that as a threat.
A fair point, and I agree. But I don't think he would actually launch anything because, again, it would lead to the end of all of us.
I think he would. You know, they've shown that multiple times, especially World War II. The Russians took 30 million casualties in World War II, and Putin and other leaders have promised that they will never fight another war on Russian soil again, regardless of the outcome. That's been a strong line for years.
Well, that doesn't. I don't think anybody is saying there would be an invasion of Russia. You know, what your premise was, Putin's statement that if any NATO nations help Ukraine, then he would use nuclear weapons on them. But that doesn't mean invade Russia. Helping Ukraine simply means driving the Russians out of Ukraine.
Don't forget that eastern Ukraine is now considered part of Russia, you know, by the Russian government.
Yeah. That's true by the Russian government, but that's still not the motherland. It's still not Russia's.
You may see it that way. They don't see it that way. They consider Crimea to be part of Russia for hundreds of years.
I know they do. I know they do. But I think if anybody fought Russian soldiers on what is Ukrainian land, no matter what Russia determines it to be, I still don't think they fire a nuclear weapon at a NATO nation, thus guaranteeing their own destruction. I don't think so.
Is it wise to risk that? I think the U.S. government needs to back off. you know, we need to assess risk. Why are we doing this? What benefit does it have to us?
Well, I mean, you know, you're discussing, you know, the entire American foreign policy, you know, of the 1950s and 1960s and 1970s. You know, we went on this massive worldwide effort to drive back and beat back communism because we had to try to figure out, you know, where would be the most strategic places for them to be to do more damage to us. Do we not provoke them and not confront them in these places, knowing we're going to have casualties and so on and so forth, and just let them continue to advance to places where then it's going to be too late for us to stop them? I mean, that's been our question forever. At what point do you let a dictator or a dictatorial authoritarian type of regime that is looking to expand its empire, or in this case, its bloc, you know, the Soviet bloc, at what point do you say we've got to make a stand here as opposed to there? And what will their response be when we do that?
The traditional stance on that is let them have their spheres of power. Every great nation has a sphere of power. It's basically a border going out, a couple hundred miles. That includes the U.S.
Yeah.
That's why the U.S. was aggressive on the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it's the same way with every other nation. That's why China's aggressive about Taiwan. You know, this is nothing new. You know what, Bob? An incredible guest, if you could get him, would be former Secretary of Defense William J. Perry.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm looking at his page right now, and, you know, you're exactly right. The William J. Perry Project is working to end the nuclear threat, so it's something I would definitely look into. Joe, I appreciate the call, my friend. Thank you. I'm going to squeeze in Jimmy and Ravenna real quick before we move on. Jimmy, go ahead.
Hey, Bob. I think sign me up for the nuclear blast.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you, brother. I'm with you. End it quickly rather than the trauma and the anxiety and the terror of ending it slowly.
Yep, but that doesn't mean that's what they're going to give us. If I were them,
right.
I would absolutely do the EMP.
Yeah,
after that, you don't need to nuke us.
Yeah, well, that's exactly the point. That's what I was saying to him. I mean, you know, you say, well, an EMP is a nuke. Yeah, it is, but it's a different type of nuke. It's detonated thousands of miles overhead, and it isn't necessarily the same type of thing that brings, you know, what a nuclear holocaust would look like.
Yeah, no radiation.
Right.
But yeah, so I signed up to be a election worker in Portage County last week and for the classes and everything for it.
Good for you.
And thank you. Got to tell you and the listeners, problem right now is with this primary being in March instead of May, is we don't have a lot of the snowbirds coming back in time to do this. So there's a big shortage of election workers. Now, the whole bipartisan thing is you always have an equal number of Democrats and Republicans. But if they don't have enough Democrats and Republicans, they'll start allowing independents to self-identify as...
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.